is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. For screenwriter and director Oliver Stone, listening to The Doors brings back memories of getting high in Vietnam. Stone just finished shooting a movie about the drugged-out 60s rock group and its leader, Jim Morrison. Stone made two films about Vietnam, Platoon, based on his tour of duty, and Born on the 4th of July, based on the autobiography of veteran Ron Kovic. Yesterday on Fresh Air, we talked with Stone about The Doors and about fighting in Vietnam. He said that 8 days after he returned from the war, he was busted for possessing about an ounce of marijuana while crossing the border from Mexico. He says his father bought his way out of a San Diego jail. Today on part two of our conversation, we find out how Oliver Stone ended up making movies, and we talk about some of the other movies he's made. Stone co-wrote and directed Salvador, Wall Street, and Talk Radio. He wrote the screenplays for Scarface, Midnight Express, Conan the Barbarian, and Year of the Dragon. I asked him how long it took after he got back from Vietnam before he started making films.
I was at a loss, I suppose. I didn't know what to do with my life, and I think I wandered around for several months in New York. And casually, you know, I'd always been interested in writing and had written. I was writing before I went to Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote something. I went there twice, you know, to Vietnam. I was there
right, once to teach English.
Yeah, to teach English. And I was in the Merchant Marine also in 65 and 6. So I'd had a stock of experiences. So I started writing a screenplay when I got back from the war. And it was about Vietnam, but it was in a wholly surreal vein. And in many ways, it became the basis for Platoon many years later in 76. The same characters, but it was a pretty psychedelic film. I enlisted under the GI Bill, a veterans bill, at NYU Film School, which was in the city, and it was convenient. It was sort of a subway school at that time. And I went to film classes the following year. And I really was lucky in that out of the blue, my first teacher turns out to be Marty Scorsese, who was really inspired and passionate about film. And he conveyed that to us as a class, which was great. And we struggled, and we made short films with 16-millimeter Bolexes. We'd go out, we'd shoot 5-minute films, 10-minute films, and 16-millimeter, and work our way up to... I did three short films, about 20 minutes at Vietnam, at NYU during those 3 years.
Did Scorsese encourage you?
Very much so. He was very, as I said, he was a great teacher to have.
What was your first big break into the industry after studying at NYU with Scorsese?
Well, it wasn't Marty alone. I mean, there was a lot of other teachers, too.
Right,
but,
right.
I think the point of film school is that nobody could get a job after they graduated. It was a bit of a joke, you know. You always you were out there on your own. You know, why were you studying it? There was a lot of, we certainly had a lot of depression about that. You know, you'd be lucky to get a PA job, a production assistant job on any film, but you couldn't get them. It was a lot different then than it is now. I mean, now the emphasis is on the youth market. So they're looking for scripts about young people. And you see a lot of the film students are going right into major directing jobs and stuff. It was really hard. I worked as a cab driver. I worked as a Xerox messenger. I worked in a temporary with temp jobs, typing pools. My first wife was supportive. She had a good job. And, you know, I wrote scripts, two scripts a year, but nobody would read them, no agents, all that kind of stuff, and shuffling back and forth, hoping for a break. I think Robert Bolt really gave me my first break in 70, about 4 years later, in 75. The English screenwriter read one of my scripts, liked it, and brought me out to work with him on the same script. He improved it with me and gave me a lot of insight. And got me an agent, my first agent in 75, about 4 years after I gotten out. And then I wrote Platoon in 76, but nobody wanted to make it, but they liked it enough that somebody at Columbia sent me over to England to work on this small book they'd bought called Midnight Express with a young director called Alan Parker. And the picture became a huge hit internationally. It was cost very little money, about $3 million. I think it made more than $100 million. It was a huge international success. And I got the Academy Award, and that opened up the door.
Did that open up the door enough for you to start directing?
Yeah, I got a chance to direct. They wouldn't let me direct the Platoon, but, or... Actually, I worked on Born on the 4th of July, too. I wrote that following the Midnight Express thing with Al Pacino, just supposed to star in it. But they wouldn't let me direct that. They would let me direct something a little in the more commercial vein. It was a horror film
the
called
Hand.
The Hand. Yeah. And it was not successful, but I learned a lot. I got to work with Michael Caine, who was taught me a lot of tricks.
Name one.
And
what's one of the tricks?
How to be cool.
Yeah, well, he's the right guy for that job.
He was a funny man.
Tell me about him showing you how to be cool. I mean, like...
Oh, I don't know. I was a pretty fiery director. You know, I wanted him to make a best effort on everything. I wanted to kill himself, you know, for the movie. And Michael had done like 30 or 50 movies, I don't know. So to him, this was like, you know, a job. You know, you go in, you check in, you do it, and you leave. And I don't know, one day I said to him at the bar, I said, look, Michael, I'm not seeing this expression on your face. I'm sorry. I just... Not excited. He said, you will, dear boy. In the rushes, you'll see them.
Did you?
Oh, I forgot. I mean, but it was a hard film to make, actually, because it was a lot of special effects. And I put myself in a no-win situation. Never make a picture about a monster that's about a foot across and, it's too small a monster to make work because you got to put very elaborate machinery inside the hand. You know, it's better to get a gorilla or a shark or something large.
I'll remember and, that.
It's very complex machinery. We had about 40 different hands, you know, that would do different things. And I worked like a dog on the film, and they kept on wanting more horror. And we never could settle that. I was always a psychological story, and I screwed it up. You know, I should have really stuck to my guns. And I learned a lesson, which was stick to your guns on a movie. Do what your first instinct. You know, if it was a psychological horror movie, that's what it should have been. And it was not really a shock movie, but it became a movie that became more known for a hand than about a mental state of Michael Caine, you see. And the film died, and I was non grata for a while, I guess, you know. Like, I forget it, you know. I went back to writing. I wrote Scarface, which was a long haul, too. I wrote Conan the Barbarian, Scarface, and You're the Dragon.
You wrote Scarface, I think, right after you'd given up drugs yourself.
Yes. Yeah.
So it must have been interesting to get so deep into the cocaine trade in the movie just as you'd stopped.
Well, I've always believed in using your own experience, you know. So if Vietnam, I wanted to use Vietnam, not let it use me. And, you know, having done a fair amount of cocaine, I never overdid it. I kind of felt like, gee, why don't I use my knowledge, you know, and put it into the Scarface character. Instead of letting the drug whip you, you know, and it does, you know, cocaine is the worst. It's a real enslaving kind of drug. It wrecks your brain cells. I put everything I knew into the film. I did a lot of research in South America. And,
did you really? You went to
Miami, America? Yeah, and Caribbean. The Caribbean is
was this
was
for
crazy.
The movie, or had you done this before?
Partly before and partly for the movie, but I remember hanging out in the Caribbean with some of these crazy guys. I mean, they're real. They're pretty wild, South Americans.
Plenty of colorful dialogue you wrote for Scarface. Do you have any favorite lines from it or lines that still get quoted to you?
Oh, yeah. There's so many. I mean, that was a cult hit, you know.
Yeah.
Every dog has his day. Every day above ground is a good day.
Did you write Don't Get High on Your Own Supply?
Yeah.
Was that your line?
Yeah. There's a lot. You remember that?
Sure.
I wasn't prepared for this, but there are a lot of lines.
God. I remember when I interviewed Robert Loggia, he did the Haza line.
That was great. Yeah. Don't be a Haza.
Yeah. In the days when you were trying to shop Platoon and Born on the 4th of July, what were the official reasons you were given for why no one wanted to make a war?
You know
movie?
What a Haza is, Frank? It's a pig that don't fly straight. That was it. God. That was a great scene when he was begging for his life. You know, you wouldn't. Don't shoot me, you know. Who you wouldn't kill a cop, whoever said you were one. What'd you say?
In the days when you were trying to shop Born on the 4th of July and Platoon and no one wanted to make a Vietnam War movie, what were the official reasons that they'd give you?
Oh, they never give you official reason, yeah. You never know why they...
Right,
you know,
but they give you reasons, whether they're the real reasons.
Too downbeat.
Uh-huh.
Depressing.
Yeah.
But, I mean, Bourne was a disgusting situation because we went through a year of work. I mean, Pacino was great in that picture. I mean, I saw the rehearsals. You know, we worked on it a lot.
Oh, you actually got that far?
Yeah, I rehearsed the whole movie. We were 3 days from shooting. We had the whole thing cast.
You're kidding.
I was the writer, and Dan Petrie was directing it. And it was all set up. The locations, it was, you know, it was... And it was a very little amount of money. I mean, it was $6 million in 1978 terms. And we just couldn't get the money wasn't there at day one of the shoot. And the whole thing folded, and it was depressing beyond words. Kovic went crazy, and I did too. And it was just—I gave up on the concept of ever really getting meaningful pictures made inside that system.
Well, I think the movie Salvador was a breakthrough film for you in a way, because you wrote and directed it. It was a critical success, if not a big commercial hit. One of the things that really struck me in Salvador was the scenes of carnage. I haven't seen it in several years, but I just remember scenes of them driving along the road or walking and coming across just piles of bodies along the road, people who had disappeared. I just remember how effectively you had handled that, and I was wondering if you could describe what you did.
I think with Salvador, which we did in 1985 with Richard Boyle, I just had it with that whole development process. You know, I decided that I was going to go the independent route completely. And I don't care what was going to happen. I was going to make a film. I told my wife, Elizabeth, I'm mortgaging the house. I'm going to borrow every dime I can get. I'm going to produce and make this film myself. You know, screw the system, basically. And with that kind of determination, I set out to go to Salvador, and we tried to make a deal with the Salvadoran military to give us their helicopters by saying that the death squads were really communists. And, you know, then we were going to shoot the other half of the movie in Mexico. We were going to show that the death squads were really government soldiers, you know, funded by the U.S. military. So we were playing like a real shell game with these guys, but we came close until our advisor, Cienfuegos, got shot one day on the tennis court. The FMLN blew his brains out and draped a flag over him. I'm in New York, and it's on the front page of the New York Times, you know. So there goes our project. But at the same time, we ran into a British company, Hemdale, and John Daly loved the thing, and he put up the dough right away. Not much, but he put up enough to get it made, and he just thought it was an anarchic kind of comedy, that it could be, you know, two wild men. He always wanted to emphasize the comedy aspect, which I agree with him. I mean, these guys, Boyle is a funny guy. And we wanted to take an irreverent approach to the war. We didn't want to get too solemn, you know, because it is a solemn issue. But it grew out of that. And what was the question?
About the carnage.
Oh, the carnage? Yeah, well, I mean, it was a shock to me. I went down there and traveled around Central America. I could see the whole thing building again. The same number as Vietnam. The same guys, the same faces, uniforms, young kids, 19. They look like me, walking around the streets of Tegucigalpa in Honduras and, you know, saying, you know, let's, you know, we're fighting communism here. You know, we're fighting this ideological enemy. And I'd ask them, do you remember Vietnam? And the guys wouldn't remember. It was driving me crazy because, you know, one of the functions of film is supposedly to, you know, relate to social history of the United States as we go. You know, that's what they did in the 30s and the 40s. To some degree, you're supposed to do that. But they didn't have any grip on Vietnam. They didn't understand it. And we were repeating the same cycle was going on. It was really depressing to me. And it sort of helped motivate me to get these films done faster. I did Salvador and Platoon back to back, you know, right there in 1985 and 6. And I think it did some good. Because I think that there was a definite, I don't want to sound too grandiose, but I thought there was a definite shift in the country in 85-6. I think Reagan, to some degree, lost his mandate. And it had a lot to do with Ollie North, because that hit in 86, right, late 86. Just when, right before Platoon came out, Ollie North broke. And 86 was the crux of the year that Reagan kind of lost it. He couldn't have that. He was building this energy to win. It was no question he was going to invade Nicaragua. No question at all.
I guess, you know, I'm curious, too, in how you, like, shot the scenes of the bodies. Did you want to talk about that?
Oh, the bodies, Yeah. You shoot bodies. How do you... I got Gordon Smith, who's, like, one of the best makeup guys in the world. He studies cadavers in hospitals.
He
digs it, you know? He goes to morgues late at night. He's like Dr. Death. So we brought him down from Canada, and he had a field day, you know, making up corpses. You get extras at 5 a.m, you get them out there, and you start making them up. And you make them look white and ashen and dead. And then you hope they don't move when you're shooting them. What else you want to know?
You must have some crazy outtakes from that.
Oh, yeah, they're always moving. When you get 600 bodies lying in a canyon, there's always some guy stands up right in the middle of it, you know? He's got to take a pee or something.
I imagine in your early films that you worked a lot off of anger and frustration. You know, anger and frustration coming both from your days in Vietnam and also from your frustration of wanting to make movies and having to work within the system and being frustrated from that. Was there a point in your career where the energy you were working off of shifted from anger and frustration to something else? I might be completely off track here, so.
Yeah, I think you're pretty close. I think that after Platoon got so much international recognition that it kind of like, okay, let's go. Let's keep going, though. But there is that original promise that was made, which is to do films a certain way and of a certain style, and they would have integrity. But now, you know, it's not so much fighting to get it made. It's like, okay, it's a given. We're going to make the picture. So you lose a lot less energy and time, you know, struggling to get it made. Now it's more like, I got a system down. I got a program. I mean, I can do one complicated picture every year because I have a great crew with producer Alex Ho and Clayton Townsend, great cameraman, great production designer, and editors, you know, so that everybody's kind of like in sync, you know. And the hard thing, of course, is keeping that crew together because people in our field are very creative and neurotic and they move on, they go to other films and other jobs. But I'm trying to keep a team together, you know, but it makes it easier.
Are the struggles different now, or the struggles within the system to cast the person you want to cast, or to keep the ending that you want to keep?
No, I don't have. Nobody changes the script because I'm accepted as a writer director of the thing or co-writer. So I do the script as I see it. Casting, yeah, there's always a bit of a struggle, you know, because you want to fit something in for a certain price. I think the salaries paid to movie actors are insane, you know. It's wrecking a lot of the fun of the business. I mean, people like Cruise, if they believe in something, we worked on Born for Nothing for a year, you know. So we got the picture made at a price of $18 million. The Doors was considerably more expensive, but not because of actors' salaries. They were all relatively young actors, and not that nobody was a big star. It was more a question of just of shooting in Los Angeles, which was complicated because it's an expensive town. And we had a lot of crowd scenes, huge amount of concerts we had to do. And music, a musical per se is more expensive. But those are the struggles. It's not like, you know, I mean, right now I think I can do pretty much any subject as long as it's not boring. I don't want to make it boring, you know. I don't want to, any social issue is good to make as long as, you know, but you can't do a film on the environment just because it's about the environment, you know, as much as we feel about it, you got to find a way to tell that story.
What kind of scripts do you have that haven't been made yet that you want to get made?
Oh, I can't tell you that.
Okay, right. And the reason why you couldn't tell me is that the fear that somebody else would say, hey, that's a great idea, I'll write that myself.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, that's what happens to me. After Platoon came out, I remember I gave an interview and somebody said, what do you want to do? What kind of, do anything completely different? I said, yeah, I'd love to do a dog story. And there hadn't been any dog stories made right around that period of time. And all of a sudden, if you notice from 86 to 89, there was like 9 dog stories that got made.
So there were? I didn't even notice.
Yeah, big ones too. And I I said, now I'm going to shut my mouth. So now I can't make a dog story.
Would you ever do a war film again, or do you feel that you've made your statement about Vietnam and about war?
No, I'd like to do another Vietnam piece, but it's not so directly about the American soldiers in Vietnam. It's more of a overview from another perspective, and I'd like to make that picture in the next 2 to 3 years. I'd like to really ultimately do this trilogy on Vietnam, make it a trilogy.
So what would the angle be on that? Oh, you probably want to talk
about it. I can't tell, it's not over yet. No, war is with us, and it will be there. I mean, I have no illusions about the Cold War being over. I think that we have a war party in the United States, and it's, you know, dedicated to spending a certain amount of money per year on a mission. Mr. Bush calls it now the war on drugs. It's the latest thing, you know.
Let me ask you about the film Wall Street. Your father was or is a stockbroker.
Was
a stockbroker. Where would he have fit into that movie, if at all?
dad would probably be a combination of Marty Sheen and Hal Holbrook. You know, he was the older broker, doing things a bit the old-fashioned way, and also a lot of the scenes between Marty and Charlie were kind of like scenes I based on my own relationship with dad.
Did he want you to go into the business ever?
Oh, when I was young, yeah, before college. Yeah, he thought it would be a good way to make a living, you know. But it was never, I never was any good at that. My mathematics were pretty dreadful. I did terribly in economics, that's right. At freshman in college, I got a D or a C in economics. I just couldn't understand economics. It's very dismal.
But
he was good at it.
But I guess all that background helped you for the movie.
The mood of the movie, yeah. I found it very confusing, but I tried to clarify. I think I did a pretty good job of... Stanley Weiser, of course, helped me. He was my co-writer, but I think we clarified the a very difficult situation. We tried to make it clear, you know, the actual mechanics of what goes on and how buyouts are made and how you can make money off stock. But Dad wouldn't recognize the new Wall Street. They're moving huge amounts of volume. It's just jumped. I mean, it's really a computerized business now. In the old days, he was a customer's man. You know, you dealt with an individual group of clients. You took care of them over time. It was a relationship, like a banker or with a small town or something like that. And he was also an economist. He wrote wonderful letters about economics for a monthly investment letter, which was very well respected in the 50s, 60s internationally. He considered himself really more of a writer than a really great businessman. But he would not recognize that Wall Street. The whole concept of making that money would elude him.
Were you a movie-obsessed kid?
Yeah, I loved the movies.
What movies made the biggest impression on you?
Oh, I went to them, all of them, the good ones. Dad would take me, Mom would take me. You know, the Kubrick pictures when I was a kid. Huge impression. Paths of Glory, Strangelove. The quality films, you know, like David Lean's pictures, Lawrence of Arabia. I remember being knocked out by Fellini's La Dolce Vita in 59 or something like that, 8.5. Then the new wave just blew me away. Godard, The Breathless, I couldn't believe. I thought that was just the new thing, you know, and then Truffaut's pictures and Chabrol. So the French took over, and then René Alain René. But I never thought I could go into movies. You know, it was something so exotic that it was not something you did for a living. It was something you just enjoyed.
You knew nobody who did something like that for a living, right?
Not really, no. We had no. My family was very New York-oriented, really didn't know L.A.
Thank you very, very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Oliver Stone. His movies include Platoon, Born on the 4th of July, Wall Street, and Talk Radio. He's completing a film on The Doors that's scheduled to come out in March. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.